Hillary Clinton was high on drugs, power mad, and tried to bribe churches into supporting her when she ran for office in 2016. That's according to a newly declassified government document. India is burying the hatchet with China to help build a new Asian alliance, and German CEOs are more powerful than ever. We'll talk about all this and more on today's Trumpet World. Russian President Vladimir Putin wanted Donald Trump to win the 2016 election because he had a whole folder full of compromising material on him. President Putin aimed to blackmail Donald Trump to do whatever Putin wanted. That's the story that we've been told pretty much ad nauseum now. And it's long been clear that that is not true. But more evidence came out this week that traces that lie directly to former President Barack Obama. And it shows us that it was, in fact, Hillary Clinton that Putin had incriminating material on. To tell us more, we'll go to our U.S. correspondent, Andrew Miller.
Yeah, this is a really big story, something that I actually didn't think we were ever going to see, where we've actually got the director of national intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, who was the vice chair of the Democratic National Committee at the time a lot of these things were taking place, releasing classified documents, proving many of the things that our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Flory, has already written up in America Under Attack, namely about this this treasonous campaign on the part of Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton to frame Donald Trump for Russia collusion, even to frame them for many of the crimes they themselves were committing. And I think the two biggest things to me that stood out from these revelations, or the biggest thing, was that this is actually the first time the federal government is actually admitting that Barack Obama was the epicenter of the coup. Mr. Gerald Flory definitely makes that in America Under Attack. There have been a few other pretty keen-eyed journalists, Lee Smith and a couple others comes to mind, who've really kept the focus on Barack Obama. But up till now, even the people who investigate this, sometimes they'll go as far as Hillary Clinton, sometimes they'll go as far as some of the people working with Hillary Clinton, but almost everybody stopped short of Obama until this week. Also, really putting a highlight, as I'll get into some of these details here in a minute, about this big meeting that Obama held on December 9th, and then the lead up to that meeting on December 7th and December 8th. Just more detail proving that Barack Obama was involved in this from the beginning. Two, as our editor-in-chief Trumpet Brief from this week brings out, his book America Under Attack compares Obama to a figure mentioned, not by name, but still mentioned in the Bible, Antiochus Epiphanes. And that December 7th, December 8th dates, just really kind of symbolic of him. That is when you do the conversion between the Hebrew dates and the Roman dates. That is the time frame that Antiochus was trying to fundamentally transform the Jewish religion from the inside, putting idols in the temple. It's also actually the anniversary of the Philadelphia Church of God and Mr. Gerald Flory's firing from the Worldwide Church of God. He mentions that leader who fired him in his book as another type of Antiochus. So between what the actual literal Antiochus was doing on December 7th in 167 BC, and then what was happening in the Worldwide Church of God in 1989, and then what was happening in the United States in 2016, I think it really just does put a big spotlight on that Antiochus angle. But anyway, a lot of information to unpack here. This is something that, because I was one of the research assistants for the America Under Attack booklet, I'm more up on these details probably than most Americans, but just to kind of go back and just kind of give you a summary of how this whole crisis unfolded is back in like October, November 2015. This was shortly after President Trump announced his intention to run for president. Actually, I think maybe just shortly before he was actually elected his first time. About a year before that, Hillary Clinton was initially gearing up to fight against Joe Biden for the Democratic nomination. And she started some opposition research into Joe Biden and his son Hunter, some of the scandals they had been involved in Eastern Europe and other places. After Joe Biden dropped out of the race, Clinton quickly pivoted from researching into dirt on Biden to getting dirt on Trump, and hired Fusion GPS to put together a dirty dossier of unverified rumors and allegations and outright lies against Donald Trump. A lot of that information later ended up in a document called the Steele dossier, which they used to try to make it look like Donald Trump was illegally colluding with Russia. And as the book America Under Attack brings out, after Devin Nunes released the 400 and some pages of documents from like FBI text messages, we actually got proof that John Brennan told the FBI agents looking into this that the White House is running this. Now, he said that in August 2016, which is a couple months before the time frame Tulsi Gabbard's talking about, which is why I said earlier that this isn't shocking that Obama was behind this in December. Because we already had information that he was behind it in August, that hadn't been declassified. Now, what Tulsi Gabbard's really putting a spotlight on is that after they'd already been working on this Steele dossier for a couple of months, the intelligence community put together a report saying there was no evidence that Russia was trying to influence the election on Trump's behalf. They put together those talking points on December 7th. I believe Obama heard the talking points on December 8th. And on December 9th, basically called a meeting of all his top spy chiefs and said, that's not good enough. Do another assessment. And this time, make the assessment say that Trump was colluding with Russia. I think Victor Davis Hanson's commentary on that is he quotes the famous Stalin quote, or maybe it wasn't Stalin, but Stalin's spy chief of like, find me the man and I'll find you the crime. So saying that he basically, they came back and said, we have no evidence that Trump's colluding with Russia or that Russia's even trying to influence the US election one way or another. And Barack Obama basically came in on December 9th. He's like, no, here's the conclusion I want in the report. Now you go make up stuff to get to that conclusion. And then, as you mentioned at the beginning, some of the documents that Gabbard's released more recently, since her initial declassification, are even indicating that Donald Trump may have had some dirt on Hillary Clinton, like I said, yeah, potential drug use or mental instability, that she and she when she decided to make up this information initially back in the early parts of 2016, she may have been kind of trying to protect herself by accusing Donald Trump of things she was guilty of, or since Lee Smith even put this possibility out. Since the Hunter Biden laptop shows that he was actually involved in like some prostitution rings in Eastern Europe, accusing him crimes that Hunter Biden was guilty of, and putting it in this dossier.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for that overview. I think that's part of the reason why people aren't more shocked animes and following the story, as I think it is something that is potentially quite complicated. But you broke it down in a really simple way. I just wanted to bring a few quotes from this document that was published this week as the latest news story. This was from the 2020 Oversight Investigation and Referral, where basically someone, I think it was meant to be high up in the CIA, went and at Devin Nunes's request, investigated the creation of this anti-Trump or the Russian collusion narrative. And it really is amazing. This five-year-old report just takes everything right back to President Obama. So this attack on Donald Trump went back to a 2016 intelligence community assessment. And this assessment that said Putin cheated in the election because he wanted Trump to win, it says that that report was subject to unusual directives from the president and other senior political appointees, so the president at the time being Barack Obama. It said that basically what they did to make this report is they took information that was pretty dubious and then lied about it, said that it was highly credible, and said that it pointed to Donald Trump colluding with Russia. It says one scant, unclear, and unverifiable fragment of a sentence from one of the substandard reports constitutes the only classified information cited to suggest Putin aspired to help Trump win. And I think exactly as you've talked about, the way that this traces it directly to Barack Obama is, I'm sure, the most important part of this. But reading this report, it was the bits about Hillary Clinton when my jaw hit the floor. Like, it's just astonishing, some of the things in there. The report says that Putin held back leaking some compromising material to use against the expected Clinton administration after they took office. So exactly what they accused Putin doing against Trump. And this then details the incriminating material. Apparently, Barack Obama and party leaders thought that Hillary Clinton's health was, quote, extraordinarily alarming, and that if it got out, it would have a serious negative impact on the election. It says that there were documents from the Democratic National Committee saying that Ms. Clinton had suffered from emotional problems, including uncontrolled fits of anger, aggression, and cheerfulness, and that she was placed on a daily regimen of heavy tranquilizers, and that while afraid of losing, she remained, quote, obsessed with a thirst for power. And then it says that Russian intelligence had, quote, details of the secret meetings offering State Department patronage to religious groups in exchange for support to the Clinton campaign. So they were offering State Department cash, but then also State Department patronage and help for these religious groups abroad. I've seen some Catholic journalists saying we need to dig into this more. It looks like there was a Vatican collusion scandal and that these unnamed religious groups were quite possibly Catholic charities. So I think that the State Department that Hillary Clinton, before running for election, used to run, was then bribing her to victory, was trying to bribe her way to victory. You know, that's a massive scandal. And then Putin had evidence of all of this. And he assumed Hillary Clinton would win, and then he could use all of that to control a Clinton presidency. I mean, we really are seeing a whole lot of evil doing exposed.
You mentioned that fragment of the sentence. That fragment actually said, I don't have the full sentence memorized, but it was like Donald Trump, comma, whose victory Putin was counting on, comma, something else. And the Federalist has an article up right now. It's titled John Brennan's Five Lies That Set Russiagate in Motion. The first one focuses on that inset sentence, on whose victory Putin counted on. No one knows who wrote that sentence or what they meant by it. But that was the only, in all the information Obama got on December 8th, they used that little fragment of a sentence. No one knows who wrote it. No one knows what it means. But they basically based the entire second fraudulent intelligence assessment on that.
So we've been talking about, in quite a lot of detail, a political scandal. But of course, Trumpet World, this is backed, sponsored by a church. And we're doing this out of a religious duty to warn the world. So why do we get in so much detail into this political story of tracing this back to Barack Obama?
Well, I think the first time Mr. Fleury really started getting into this, even before he wrote America Under Attack, it was in a Trump editorial titled Saving America from the Radical Left Temporarily. And he made a pretty bold claim, a claim that some people, I think, have even accused us of sounding melodramatic or extreme, that he felt that if Hillary Clinton would have won the 2016 election, like, we would have lost our country. And obviously that doesn't mean that, like, the North American continent would have disappeared or everybody on it would have died. But basically the idea that, like, if this type of stuff didn't come to light and Barack Obama got away with using this parenthetical phrase, comma, on whose victory Vladimir Putin was counting, to keep Donald Trump out of office, then the Constitution would be dead. We would no longer live in a democratic republic. We'd be living in a authoritarian technocracy, a dictatorship, where really whoever was the president could use the CIA and the FBI to rig elections and install whatever puppet leader they wanted. And so that's the stakes here. It's like, it's basically a loss of freedom, a loss of the ability to elect your own leaders, the loss of ability to make your own decisions, and looking into a Marxist dictatorship. Now, that same article, it goes back to a prophecy in 2 Kings 14, verses like 26 through 28, that talks about end time Israel being suffered from bitter affliction, and then God saving them by the hand of an end time type of King Jeroboam II. If you look at the history of King Jeroboam II, his father and his grandfather reigned at times when Israel was under heavy attack from the Syrians, particularly King Hazael and his son Ben-Hadad III. And the history is that these two kings were basically about to wipe out the northern kingdom of Israel. And then God had to raise up this king to war. And he actually recovered all the land that Ben-Hadad and Hazael had taken from Israel. And then even some more land, even spreading up to Hazael and Ben-Hadad's capital in Damascus and taking that. And making Israel greater than it ever was since Solomon. And then Jeroboam, he died, and Israel became a vassal to Assyria within just a few years after that. So it's just kind of like this last gasp of greatness for Israel. And he's likening that to, like I said, the Trump administration, not the Trump administration, the Obama-Biden administration was on the verge of transforming America into a dictatorship where the American people, they wouldn't be living in a functioning constitutional republic. They wouldn't have their freedoms. They'd be living in a dictatorship. And then God used an end time Jeroboam II, in this case, Donald Trump, to stop all that from happening. Now, similar to history, it's like if that Jeroboam figure, if like the nation doesn't repent during this resurgence, then you become a vassal state to Assyria, just like happened anciently. But it's like the last chance for America to repent. And so the reason we focus so much on some of these details here is that to really make the case that like God is saving America temporarily and that America was on the verge of losing its freedoms. It's easy to just kind of brush past that and say that like, well, yeah, Obama was a bad president or Biden was a bad president and he's gone now and we don't have to worry about it. But to understand this Jeroboam prophecy, you do have to realize that like, well, in the language of 2 Kings 14, Israel was on the verge of being blotted out from under heaven. And then God stopped that through this Jeroboam figure. So this Gabbard report, if she's talking about treasonous sedition and coups and like focusing in on sentence fragments to try to keep Donald Trump from office, it really just does show how close the nation came to being in a nation where your vote doesn't even matter because the CIA is just going to pick your president for you.
Yeah, thank you for that. And so, we're warning that our nations, particularly America, Britain, the Jewish state, and the Middle East, these nations are going to be brought down because of sin. And we are doing things that are causing a whole lot of evil and suffering. God is bringing about punishment. And a lot of this show, we focus on that externally, these nations that God is raising up to punish Britain and America. And an important component that of that, though, is we're also being brought down from within, from things that we're doing, but then also from evil influences working inside our countries. And that's something that Mr. Flurry focused on when he had his Key of David in 2024, where he advertised this book, America Under Attack, that really exposes this attack that traces everything back to Barack Obama, years before Tulsi Gabbard just did today. And here's how he opened that Key of David.
Greetings, everyone. I have never mentioned my hardcover book on TV before. It's about America Under Attack, and I wanted to talk to you about it today. Of course, it is free, as all of our literature is. And it was first printed in 2013 in a little small paperback. But since that time, we have made it, and I have expanded it into a much bigger book, and we've made it in a hardcover, so it is a very impressive book just to see. But this is something that can afflict political parties. It can certainly apply to churches. And it is a problem that's pretty widespread. Across the globe, people are still asking the question, well, what is happening inside of America? That's asked by people overseas quite often. Now, we're still aware of Abraham Lincoln's statement about the last best hope on earth here in America. But that hope is in danger. And it is something we all need to be concerned about because the problems that we have are within. The attack is from within. That's a real problem.
So this is an important story to understand, and we do have that free book, America Under Attack, that we'd be very happy to send you, that will give you a lot more information about this and really exposes the spiritual dimension to these critical stories. What else did you spot of significance from the English-speaking world this week, Andrew?
Yeah, I'll do three other quick stories here. While we're talking about foreign interference in America's political system and the hoaxes surrounding it, the U.S. House Judiciary Committee did actually find an example of some foreign interference in America this week that doesn't involve Donald Trump. Particularly, it was talking about how the Chinese Communist Party is using U.S. courts to breach national security using bipartisan hearings. And so we've written some on this program before about just about the extensive reach of the Chinese Communist Party, especially into academia in America, even lobbying politicians. We had a cover on the Trumpet titled like Wake Up to the Threat from China, showing that they've even got some leverage over a lot of these activist judges that are causing America so much problem there that the House wants to start looking into that as well. And then two other stories from the English-speaking world, but not about the United States. Try not to forget about the British Commonwealth nations too many weeks in a row. But in Australia, a former prime minister of them, Scott Morris, actually came to the United States, talked to the U.S. House of Representatives, and he really highlighted how his country is at threat from like falling asleep to what he called a Chinese charm and flattery campaign. Basically, talking about some of the similar things that the House of Representatives investigating due to like Chinese influencing courts here in America. But as bad as in the United States, just the Chinese influence over the political system, particularly, and not just Chinese, but like the Communist Party, Chinese Communist Party influence over Australia's political system is even more concerning than it is here. And it's pretty concerning here. And then in the UK, a story you wrote about this week, reform leader Nigel Farage, someone that many people in the America movement are hoping will be Prime Minister of UK someday, really using some strong speech about Britain being on the brink of societal collapse is the way he phrased it, and really talked a lot about like the violent migrant gangs and civil disobedience being done on a mass scale in Britain. They've same as like we had the migrant crisis with under Joe Biden, like I said, Britain's had a migrant crisis, primarily Islamic immigration for many years. That's resulting in more and more gangs that are really just operating outside the law, that the police don't even have the will to attack anymore. And so he's definitely trying to put a spotlight on that in hopes that some of the British people fed up with the lawlessness will vote reform in a future election.
And actually, linking both your stories together and talking of articles where my jaw just about hit the floor, we have an article that will be up on our website by the time this goes out from Callum Wood, our Australian correspondent, talking about immigration in Australia, where they had the equivalent of 2% of their population arrive in just 5 months. It is a staggering rate of migration into there. And in that article, he kind of delves into the root causes that are the same reasons why Britain's government has opened the floodgates to migration, Canada as well. So that's just a really eye-opening article, Australia's immigration crisis. If you want to hear more, I think we'll be hopefully neglecting the land down under a little less with having a few more pieces of material from Mr. Wood. So I'm really looking forward to getting more on that. And that's just a great article you can get on our website. Well, talking about the other side of the world, there's a significant alliance brewing in Asia between India, Japan, and Russia. We'll get the latest on this from our Asia correspondent, Jeremiah Jacques.
The big story that I wanted to talk about is that a deep alignment between Russia, China, and India is now taking shape, and this marks a big win for Russia, especially, and it marks an equally large loss for the United States. There was a new report about this published by the National Security Journal this week, and it brings together a lot of powerful evidence just showing these three mammoth nations coming together. These three, by the way, they have a combined population of 3 billion people. They generate about 22% of the world's gross domestic product, and they are all increasingly fueled by anti-American sentiments. So that shows you really the power represented by this Russia-China-India group. And it shows that it could soon be reshaping the geopolitical landscape in Asia and beyond. And the interesting part of this equation really is India. You know, Russia and China, for their part, that part of the triangle is nothing new. It's been clear for years that they are closely partnered and thick as thieves, backing each other as they try to push against the global order. The partnering of those two has been just glaringly evident for years now. But India's interest in joining Russia and China was long in doubt. But what we've seen over the last few years is that India has been tilting more and more toward Russia. We see this in India's weapons purchases from Russia. We see it in the diplomatic support that India gives to Russia in the United Nations and other international bodies. And probably most significantly, we see it in these massive purchases of Russian oil that the Indians have been making, even as the rest of the world sort of tries to wean itself off of Russian energy. And that has been a huge part of what has allowed Russia to keep on financing its war against Ukraine. So that has been kind of the general trend for the last several years. But now we have a new factor in this equation, and that is the Trump administration's kind of erratic tariff policy, you know, tariffs on, tariffs off, tariffs of this amount, and now tariffs of that amount. And so at this point, India's posture toward Russia has actually moved from cautious tilt to active alignment. Okay, and then we come to China, even more significant. You know, any discussion about India in this context is incomplete without talking about its decades-long rivalry with China. That's largely over territorial disputes that India and China have, and also just strategic competition in Asia. But the truth is, 5 years have passed now since the last flare-up of their border dispute, and India today understands that it is not mighty enough to engage China as an open adversary. So we have been seeing some major moves toward an India-China reconciliation over the last few months. The first of these came back in October. That's when Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi made the decision to meet face-to-face with Chinese leader Xi Jinping. Modi and Xi Jinping met on what you could call neutral ground in Kazan, Russia, really on the territory of the only power that could unite these two rivals. And Modi agreed at that time to cede some ground to China, giving China kind of a de facto control over some disputed areas along their border. That was a major move. And then earlier this month, we saw a very big follow-up to that when a group of Indian officials traveled to Beijing. No neutral territory this time. This time the Indians went inside of China for this meeting, and that marked the first visit of this kind in 5 years. During that visit, the Indians and Chinese, they mapped out some ways to deepen their trade and expand bilateral trade, and also to further de-escalate border tensions and just to kind of reset diplomatic relations. And then just on Wednesday of this week, India resumed tourist visas for Chinese citizens after about a 5-year gap in those. So another significant step there. And it all shows that India and China are burying the hatchet. And it's happening really under the guidance of Vladimir Putin's Russia, guided by Putin's hand. You know, he's the one who is bringing the three nations together. And the National Security Journal said that this shows that this new Russia-China-India bloc is becoming a fundamental factor in Asian and global politics. Now, some analysts and some onlookers have been pretty surprised by this development, especially considering India's history of deep rivalry with China and its history of always trying to avoid being pulled fully into Russia's orbit. But the trumpet has actually been warning for decades that these Asian nations would join forces in the modern era. And that's because of biblical prophecy. The scriptures show that an Asian army of 200 million soldiers will be one of the major belligerents in World War III. And we have a booklet called Russia and China in Prophecy that goes into detail about all the various Bible passages that discuss this future Asian military force. It takes a close look at a passage in Ezekiel 38, 1 and 2, which shows that Russia will be the head of this Asian bloc, with China kind of as a secondary or junior leader in the bloc. And then verse 5 in that chapter lists some ancient names for the peoples that primarily make up modern India. And it says that they will also be a part of this Russia-led bloc. So when we see India today drawing closer to Russia and making peace with China, that's really building the foundation for this prophesied power to come together. And when you consider India's population, it's now the world's largest after having passed up China's a few years ago. You can see how that will play a big role in bringing this Asian force up to that unprecedented number of 200 million soldiers. So for anyone who would like to understand these passages and these various prophecies and to see how current events are fulfilling them, I would recommend ordering a free copy of our booklet, Russia and China in Prophecy.
Well, thank you very much for that, for a very precise, specific fulfillment of Bible prophecy that we can see there. What other stories from Asia did you have for us?
Yeah, first up is just a quick story about Japanese politics. The winds of change are blowing in Japan, and the Liberal Democratic Party has actually just lost its majority in both houses of parliament for the first time since that party was founded back in 1955. So that's a major event that's happening there, and it happened because some right-wing parties are gaining more and more ground in Japanese politics. One of these is the Democratic Party for the People. That one's been gaining a lot more ground. And even more significant is the Sanseito Party, which is a real right-wing party. The head of the Sanseito Party has compared it to the AfD in Germany. The party is very much built on what you could call Japanese first policies. The founder has expressed support for Vladimir Putin in the war against Ukraine. And he has even called for Japan to restore political power to the emperor of Japan. So to see this party gaining ground and gaining so much ground that now the Liberal Democratic Party that has ruled for decades is losing its majority and has lost its majority, that is very significant. It shows that Japan's going through some real political instability right now. And that instability could end up driving Japan away from its long-standing alliance with the United States and closer to Russia and China, just as we saw with the Indian story a moment ago. And then another development that I wanted to mention is that China is supplying Russia with drone engines so that Russia has plenty of drones to be able to kill Ukrainian civilians and soldiers. That's nothing new. We've seen plenty of stories over the last few years about China supplying Russia with drones. But this week, we learned that China is sending a lot of these disguised as refrigerators. So a new report from Reuters goes into the details of this. It shows that the labels indicate that these are actually refrigerators and the packaging is deceptive. That way, China is able to circumvent sanctions that ban shipments of militarily useful items to Russia. So it's very clever, and it has worked very well for the Chinese and the Russians. And it's just one more indication of how insidious the partnership between these two nations has become. And then the last story I wanted to talk about is a flare-up between Cambodia and Thailand, two Asian nations that we don't speak about as often. These are smaller. And you could say that this is all France's fault. It's not really France's fault, but the French colonized Cambodia back in the 1800s, and they drew a map with a border making the line between Cambodia and Thailand. And apparently the way this line was drawn is subject to some interpretation. And so Cambodia claims some of the same land that Thailand claims. And they've been fighting over this for decades now, but it has flared up again recently. It started actually back in May when troops exchanged fire near that disputed border. And at least one Cambodian soldier was killed at that time. And there have been more eruptions since then, especially just over the last couple of days. At least 16 people now have died. There's also a Thai soldier who had his leg blown off from a landmine. Thailand is saying that Cambodia has suddenly mined parts of their border. So it really does seem to be heating up now. I think it was yesterday that Cambodia fired some rockets into Thailand. And then Thailand responded by deploying one of their F-16s to bomb Cambodia. Thailand is a United States ally, so they have American jets like the F-16. So this could keep on heating up. You know, Thailand is a U.S. ally and Cambodia is a Chinese ally. So it could become kind of a, you know, a China versus America proxy war, or it may die down. It's hard to say for sure, but there are hot spots right now erupting all over the world. And now we can add Cambodia and Thailand to that list.
Thank you for that, Jeremiah. Well, the news from Europe also revolves around an important meeting. This time, it's not an international one. On July 21st, the German Chancellor Friedrich Merz held a big business meeting. The leaders of 61 companies attended. They promised to make Germany a global investment hub, and they pledged 631 billion euros. That's nearly three quarters of a trillion dollars in investments to be spent within Germany over the next 3 years. And you know, this is that's a big headline sounding number, nearly $1 trillion. I mean, as with all of these, it's big, it's impressive. You scrutinize it more closely. It maybe doesn't look quite as impressive as it did initially, because companies, of course, will package in things they were going to do anyway. Even so, German businesses have tended to invest a lot of money building factories outside Germany. For them to bring to this home within Germany is still a fairly big deal. But we have an article on our website from Joshua Michels that I think brings out an even bigger deal and an even more important point from this meeting. And that is how influential German business leaders are within the German government. The German Chancellor, a lot of his key ministers come straight out of the business world. I was just reading a different piece this morning talking about how confident German businesses and even worldwide businesses are in Friedrich Merz because he talks their language. He is able to articulate very well what he wants to do to make Germany business friendly, what he wants to do to address Germany's economy. It's leading to a lot of money coming back to Germany from the United States. And you have reached this point where German CEOs are more influential in this government than ever before. The Deutsche Bank CEO, Christian Sewing, Siemens CEO, Roland Busch, they were there. They're the co-founders of their Made for Germany initiative. Sewing said, "We now need to send a clear signal to society that something is happening here. As an alliance of many leading companies, we want to work closely with politicians to help put Germany and Europe on a growth path." Bush said, "We need the courage to make structural changes in politics and major steps must follow. But we also need companies that believe in the location and are willing to invest. Both must come together quickly to build momentum." So you have a very close partnership in this government, closer than we've had in a lot of previous German governments, between business and politics. And I think this is really significant because of something Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry has drawn attention to. He gave a whole Key of David where he really focused on German business leaders and their influence in the German government. And he explained why that fits right in with Bible prophecy. I've got a clip from that Key of David or some portions from it. It's fairly lengthy, but it explains why this subject matters really well. So we can play that now.
Let me give you comments that she made, and this is from the Telegraph newspaper, and here's what it says. Angela Merkel admitted she was helpless, quote unquote, to resist pressure from German business to support the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline, Donald Tusk claimed at the weekend. Just think about helpless to resist that pressure from these business leaders. What does that mean? No choice because of all that pressure from these business leaders. Can you tell me what that means? Can we really understand that? That's not something we ought to just pass over quickly, but we need to look into this and see what is happening. And I'll tell you, we're going to be shocked, and many people are going to be somewhat, I think, intensely frightened by it. This is serious trouble that she's talking about, although if you don't know German history and Bible prophecy, you really won't understand that much about it. Here's what the Correspondence Corps said 57 years ago, leading German industrialists, that's what Chancellor Merkel was talking about. German industrialists, German leaders, German business leaders. The leading German industrialists founded a society which they called Pan-German League. Its slogan was Deutschland über alles, Germany over all. They utilized the trademark Made in Germany is proof of German superiority. Behind their commercial and business methods was a central permanent strategy with the goal of conquering the world. There it is again. Their goal was to conquer the world and still is. And you can prove that by their own history. It was they who were largely responsible for inducing the Kaiser to enter World War I. It was they who were behind World War II, cooperating with a German militarist, and the secret movement started by General Ludendorff, who selected Adolf Hitler as his stooge and protege. These same industrialists financed the Nazi movement and actually elevated Hitler to power. Senator Kilgore's report at that time to the Senate Military Affairs Committee calls attention to this fact. Hitler was merely a tool. He was the rabble-rouser they needed to sway the masses of German people to get behind their fanatical plot for world rule. Now, that's exactly what Angela Merkel was talking about. These business industrialists knew if they lost the war, they would just blame Adolf Hitler, and then they themselves would be free to continue on for a third round. In other words, they started World War I, and they started World War II, and they're going to start World War III, according to your Bible. A terrible prophecy, but it nevertheless is there. We often talk about it as Armageddon, but it's certainly prophesied in your Bible in many prophecies, like 100 of them. Now, these industrial barons, well, after World War was over, they went underground. They went into the bottomless pit. They just keep doing it over and over and over, and you never can clear the pit of this evil. They just keep right on coming until Jesus Christ personally stops this group of people. So, I mean, from the beginning, these German industrialists have led a double life. Now, you need to think about that. They've led a double life. If you look at their past, they were secretly collaborating fully with the Nazis, and then they went on to collaborate with them after World War II. And I'll show you evidence of that. There's ample evidence of it. Plenty of evidence. See, whatever it is, again, it doesn't matter what you call it, but it's really a very dangerous event.
So there's a lot of history here. Mr. Fleury had an article as well, Rising from the German Underground, where he gives even more history of the way that German businesses have repeatedly enabled the rise of the German Empire, certainly in the run-up to World War II, but they've played major roles in a lot of other resurrections of this empire. And this is right in line with very basic Bible prophecies. In Revelation 17, we talk about a lot on this show because it so clearly refers to a power that's rising up in Europe. It's a power that rises and falls repeatedly. You know, it says in verse 10, there are seven kings, five are fallen, one is. So there are kings that come one after the other. And well, verse 8 says, the beast you saw was and is not, and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit. So you have one king and he rules for a while. And then the beast seems like it disappears from the world. It goes into the bottomless pit. It goes underground. It comes back up again and you have another resurrection. And the symbolism at the start of this chapter, talking about a great hall leading this beast, shows that it's led by a church. And where do you have an empire that rises and falls repeatedly and is led by a church? That's only Europe. That's pretty basic and easy to prove. This is the Holy Roman Empire in Europe. Then you get to chapter 18, and it immediately starts talking about all the wealth of this nation and all the merchants of the earth, as verse 3 talks about, and all the trade that's going on. It has a very strong relationship with the business community, to put it in modern English. It makes them rich. It makes them wealthy. And they have a whole lot of influence, and they help rise up this power out of the underground. So this is right out of Bible prophecy, what you see now. These businessmen working hand in hand with the German government. And you could read more about that in Mr. Fleury's article, Rising from the Underground. You could also watch that Key of David that was called Rising from the German Underground. And we could put links to both in our show notes. So I think it's a story that would be very easy to overlook, apart from perhaps those in the business community or really zeroed in on economic news. But you bring that perspective that Mr. Flurry spoke about in that Key of David, and it makes it really important. A few other important stories from Europe this week. We are seeing a shift in Germany's attitude when it comes to this trade war with Donald Trump and America. According to the Wall Street Journal this week, they're making this shift. So previously, Germany had been kind of pro-compromise with President Trump. And okay, just give him what he wants. We might not get any great concessions, but we really need to sell our cars to America. So we will work very hard for a deal, and we don't want to antagonize President Trump. And as the de facto leaders of Europe and the largest economy, that held a lot of weight within Europe. Wall Street Journal at least reports that that has now shifted, and that Germany is now kind of getting on side by side with France and being much more confrontational. They quote one anonymous German official saying, if they want a war, they will get a war. And this comes as the Trump administration reportedly refused two key German demands. Germany wanted a minimum 10% tariff. It looks like the minimum tariff is going to be higher than that. And then also Germany wanted some kind of system where they got a discount on their tariffs for every car that they made within the United States and then exported. And apparently the Trump team said, well, that's just too complicated. You can't have that. Now, because this is based on anonymous leaks, I think it is worth taking with a pinch of salt. This could just be part of posturing between the two sides. However, I think it is indicative of a hardening attitude within Germany to the United States. You're seeing more and more of a hostility to the United States that, at least on professional levels, has been kept a bit more under wraps. It wouldn't surprise me at all if Europe does compromise and give America what they want. But that shift in attitude is important, and it's going to lead to Europe working to create this worldwide trade alliance that all of their merchants benefit from, that they will weaponize against the United States. That's the long-term future of this. We're also seeing a lot more movement on the German military, some important stories there. The German cabinet approved a bill that is going to help the German military expand more quickly, build bases more quickly, buy stuff more quickly, basically making it easier for them to bypass the complicated tender rules where you have to let lots of businesses compete and have a very clear system to judge who gets the contract. The Defense Minister Boris Pistorius called this new measure a groundbreaking law. So this was approved by the cabinet. It's still got to go through the German parliament, but they're working on beefing up their military more quickly. Emmanuel Macron and Friedrich Merz held a meeting recently this week. I think that was on Wednesday, where they sat down. They talked about coordinating their response on tariffs, but also talked about the working together on the Future Combat Air System, this new joint production between Germany and France, where they want to produce a new fighter jet and other parts of that. That's become a little gummed up because France wants to control 80% of the production there. And it looks like basically Emmanuel Macron kind of agreed, yeah, that's a bit ridiculous. We'll negotiate on that. And so we're going to see, I think, France and Germany work more quickly on this part of Germany's remilitarization. So that's an important story. And then on this front, Germany agreed to sell 40 Eurofighter Typhoon jets to Turkey. And I think that's important both for the impact on Turkey and the Middle East, where you're seeing Germany cement this defense relationship with Turkey. I mean, this is going to be critical. You look at, say, what's been going on in Syria, where because Syria has been killing Druze, Israel had a couple of strikes on Syria and Damascus. The Syrian government then turned to Turkey and said, can you defend Damascus? Can you take responsibility for our air defense? So for then Germany to be cementing this relationship with Turkey, Turkey is their bridge to a lot of the rest of the Middle East. And these relationships are going to help Germany then become much more influential across a lot of the Middle East. And as you see, and I think it's ironic that even Israel is helping this happen. Yes, great, they're confronting Iran and they're pushing back on Iran's Shiite terror groups, but it's Sunni groups with links to Turkey that are moving in and receiving a lot of the spoils of that victory. So that's important. But then also the fact that now Germany is more keen to share its military technology and to sell abroad and to sell to countries like Turkey, where you have accusations of human rights abuse, that's going to make it easier for other countries within Europe to partner with Germany and to work together with Germany. Germany, because of their World War II history, has more restrictions on who they can sell weapons to. And if you've worked together on this weapon system with Germany, Germany can end up kind of putting the brakes on this whole exporting deal. With Germany now more willing, with those brakes on Germany lifted, it's going to make it easier and easier for Germany to become this big manufacturing hub for all of Europe. So watch that aspect of the story as well. Talking about Germany's influence in the Middle East, France's influence in the Middle East, France officially closed its permanent military base, so its permanent military presence in Senegal. That leaves Djibouti. It is the only country holding a major French base. And this is a major setback for France that has, for a long time, had deep, deep ties with its African colonies, more so than other colonial powers have really held with their former colonies. It comes after coups, Islamic movements have swept across North Africa. There's really a recipe for chaos in North Africa, and watch for this to force Europe to step back in, but watch for Germany to be the one taking the lead there rather than France. So, lots of news from Europe this week. The main news from the Middle East also relates to the Catholic Church and very important component of this Holy Roman Empire getting much more involved within Israel and within Gaza. We had a bit on this story last week, but we've had some very important developments on that that Mihailo Zekic is going to share with us now.
Yes, it was breaking just as we were making last week's episode. The Latin Patriarch of Jerusalem, Cardinal Pier Battista Pizzaballa, was basically over the Catholic Church in Israel and the Palestinian territories. He actually visited Gaza starting on Friday. We talked before about how he had these comments about this, the one Catholic Church in Gaza, how Israel struck it, and he had a lot of hard things to say about that. He actually was able to get inside Gaza himself to visit the church, to speak with the local Christian community, and to basically show that he still has, him and his organization still has a stake in everything going on. There are a couple things that are significant about that. One thing, it's really, really rare for Israel to open up the border with Gaza with an active war zone happening there to foreign leaders like that. To my knowledge, he is the most prominent person to that isn't Israeli to actually go and do that. But he also brought with him some company, the Greek Orthodox Patriarch Theophilos III. So there are two separate patriarchs of Jerusalem governing two different branches of Christianity, which to an outside observer may look very, very similar. They have very similar rituals, but they have different jurisdictions. They technically don't recognize each other. But this case, they were able to walk with each other into Gaza. The Latin Patriarchates of the Catholic Church said the entourage included, quote, hundreds of tons of food supplies, as well as first aid kits and urgently needed medical equipment. In addition, the Patriarchate ensured the evacuation of individuals injured in the attack to medical institutions outside Gaza where they will receive care, end quote. So in other words, this whole supposed blockade that Israel is putting on Gaza, that how they're starving civilians, etc., even though that's demonstrably false. The Catholic Church, with this visit, put itself basically at the forefront saying, we stop that. We are coming in and bring everything they need. The Catholic Church looks really good with what it is doing right now. And the Orthodox Patriarchate, meanwhile, called Pizzaballa a, quote, brother in Christ, and the visit, quote, a powerful expression of ecclesial unity and fraternal solidarity in the face of the deepening human suffering in the Strip. These two churches have not had communion with each other for almost 1,000 years. As so much as you go back a few decades, the idea that the two patriarchs could walk practically hand in hand and say these things, how they're brothers and that there's unity, that would have caused a stir and probably a resignation from somebody. But you hear statements like this from Catholic figures, from Orthodox figures all the time. Our predecessor magazine, The Plain Truth, and its editor-in-chief, Herbert W. Armstrong, were predicting for decades that there is going to be a unity coming between the Catholic and Orthodox churches. That official unity doesn't exist yet. They still technically don't recognize each other as being part of the same spiritual body on paper. But at this point, that's only a formality. But going back to the Catholic Church's response to Israel specifically, you look at this kind of open, you could say, opposing of what they claim is Israeli policy. Why is the Catholic Church so hostile to how Israel has been conducting this? We talked before about how they insinuated that Israel may have deliberately struck this church, even though there's no reason for Israel to do this whatsoever. Well, two Mondays ago, both Pizzaballa and Theophilus, again, a joint visit, visited a West Bank community where Israeli settlers allegedly set fire to a church there, and Israeli police are being complicit. You dig into the details of this story, and the church that they supposedly set fire to was an archaeological site from the Byzantine era. There's nobody there. It's like a ruined building in a field. And the fire itself, you look at video footage, and it appears that the Israeli settlers were actually trying to help put out the fire rather than starting it. So go to, like, Israelis come to put out a fire in an archaeological site, and the headlines are that Israelis set fire to a Palestinian church, of course. But that, leaving that aside, according to the Catholic medium Pillar, quoting sources close to the Patriarchate, they said that regarding the tank strike in the Gaza Strip, quote, internally, church authorities were considering the possibility that the tank attack was a direct response, end quote. So, in other words, he's saying that the IDF retributed something he said, just words he said at a visit he said, by killing Catholics. That is a grave allegation that even many of Israel's other prominent critics in the international community, in the press, wouldn't even go as far as to suggest. But the Catholic Church only recognized Israel as a sovereign entity in 1993. That's before, after Egypt, Israel's former biggest enemy, did in the 80s. It's after the Soviet Union did, which is another one of Israel's biggest enemies. And when the State of Israel was coming together, the Catholic Church, A, originally they opposed the creation of a Jewish state. B, they wanted Jerusalem for themselves. They wanted oversight over Jerusalem. There is a lot of baggage coming in with that relationship. And if you look at it from a biblical perspective, you were talking about Revelation 17, you were talking about the Holy Roman Empire. It's the Holy Roman Empire. The Catholic Church, the Vatican, plays an integral part in not just putting this empire together, helping these countries come together, but also guiding it on what to do, on how to interact with its neighbors, on how to push its weight around. And a lot of that has to do with who controls Jerusalem and policies with the Jewish state today. One particular prophecy I wanted to zero in on is in Isaiah 47, which speaks of the Catholic Church prophetically as a woman, and we have resources on our website that go into more detail about that. Verse 8 says that this woman says, neither shall she know the loss of her children, and we've always spoken to that referring to this mother institution bringing back its wayward daughters into the fold, including the Orthodox Church.
And Mr. Armstrong had a lot to say about this, like you've said. I just wanted to play a clip where he was sitting down with the acting president of Cyprus and talked about the role that the Catholic Church will have, both in uniting with the Orthodox Church, but then using that to build and empower Europe.
And we're going to now have a revival very soon of that. There was a revival of it in 554 called the Holy Roman Empire. And that had a few revivals up until the time of Napoleon and ended in 1814. And I see that coming up once again. I think it's going to be a union between the nations that are Roman Catholic and the nations that are Orthodox Catholic.
Well,
and religion is going to play a part in that again. Religion has played such a part in wars in the past.
Yes. Yes. It played a part in wars in the past, but I don't believe that it will play such a role in the future. Do you believe that religion will be a cause of war in the...
Well, I don't know whether I'd say it's going to be a cause of war, but It is going to be a religious union of nations. I tell you, the God of all of our religions is going to step in supernaturally, by supernatural power.
Now, if people would like to learn more about the Catholic Church's role in the Middle East and its relations with Israel, Mr. Gerald Fleury had an article in 2014 called The Dark Side of the Pope's Visit to Jerusalem. That was when Pope Francis made his inaugural trip to the Middle East there, and elaborating on some of the symbolism of that visit. For this current situation, we also have an article on our website, Patriarch of Jerusalem Accuses Israel of Massacring Catholics, that goes into a little more detail about that. Well, that, I guess you could say, is the big Europe-Israel relations story that's been going on for the past week or so. But it's not the only one. On Thursday, French President Emmanuel Macron announced that France would recognize a Palestinian state at the opening of the United Nations General Assembly in September. Would normally be big news, except that he already said he was going to do this, and he was going to do it in June. And so now he's pushed back the deadline. But this time around, he did send a letter to Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas saying he was going to do this. So at the very least, it's looking optically a bit harder for him to back out of this now. Again, the fact that he keeps kicking the can down the road and threatening the nuclear option without doing it sounds like he wants something from Israel, and he's trying to see what Israel will get him, whether it's an end to the war or something like that. Leave it to Mr. Macron to be a master of these kind of slippery politics, so we'll see what happens with that. But also on Monday, Romania confirmed a deal where the Israeli defense firm Rafael, one of the most prestigious, well-regarded defense contractors in the world, would give them Spider anti-aircraft defense systems. So this isn't Iron Dome. Rafael also produces Iron Dome, but it is also part of the same general, something comes in the sky, we can shoot it down with relative ease. Romania borders Ukraine, has been having debris from Russian drones being shot down, land in its territory, and they're probably thinking long-term in case if this war heats up, in case if maybe some Russian missiles miss their target and go into Romanian territory, they want to be prepared for it. But again, Rafael is who makes Iron Dome. It's one of Israel's most important companies. The Israeli government obviously relies on them a lot. And you're seeing this trend. Romania is not the first to purchase defense systems like this from Europe, of these Israeli companies trusting Europe more and more with these really critical, really sensitive technologies that Israel relies on to defend itself. And there's a prophecy in Ezekiel 23 of Israel, or of the state of Israel, Judah, relying on European lovers, so to speak, or allies, on these intimate relationships with defense, like what we're seeing right now. And God thunders in Ezekiel 23 that that's going to come back to bite Judah and the other nations of Israel in a major way. When you start giving weapon systems like this, I mean, that also gives the enemy knowledge of how your own defense systems work and how you can disable them and what their weaknesses are. You don't generally give these kinds of systems to people you don't trust never to attack you. But that Bible says that's exactly what is going to happen from Europe to Judah and the other nations of Israel.
And then I think one other story that is worth talking about from the Middle East, largely because there's a big element of good news here, is, I mean, we've seen a lot of very tragic stories of anti-Semitism this week. You had, and that is very clearly not good news, you had a Jewish broadcaster straight chased down the streets of London, being called fascist Zionist scum. Just a woman dining at a restaurant asked if she was a Jew and then had food thrown over her, a mob with knives attacking a Jewish teenager.
There's been a lot of people, like that cruise ship that was supposed to go to Greece that from Israel that wasn't even allowed to let its passengers off. There was the flight in Spain.
Right, the flight in Spain I was just going to get to. That was really shocking, where you had about 50 Jewish children coming from a summer camp in Spain being thrown off a flight after the children sang Hebrew songs. And then the leader was arrested, thrown to the ground. But what I wanted to focus on is this week, to his credit, Donald Trump is standing up to a lot of this hateful movement. I mean, the United Nations has become a major spreader of anti-Semitism, and he announced the US will withdraw from UNESCO, the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, largely because of this bias, and also because of its basically its ideological agenda that the State Department said is at odds with our America First foreign policy, which is kind of true. Two, it's very much in China's pocket. But between 2009 and 2019, UNESCO passed 71 resolutions condemning Israel, and then over the same time period, it passed two against all other nations. So this is very clear, you know, Israel is not 35 times more a threat to science, culture, education than the entire rest of the world combined. And this is an organization that exists to promote cultural heritage and archaeology, which they do everywhere except Israel, where they actually try to suppress archaeology and cultural heritage because that proves the Jews' ancestral claim to the land. So it's good news to see President Trump step up and pull out of that. Well, thank you very much for joining us. Thank you to all of our panelists. I also wanted to conclude with just one more clip from Mr. Armstrong's chat with the president of Cyprus. Some of the news back then was similar to what we're seeing right now, and he puts that in just an incredible overview for sitting down with a secular leader.
And is going to shake up this world and is going to bring about such a condition that he's going to change the nature in us until human nature will change and we'll quit doing this and begin to cooperate a little bit with one another, and then we'll have peace. We can't, God isn't going to come and just wave a magic wand and give us peace while we still go on living like we do. Take the trouble in the West Bank. I know how the Israelis look at it, because I'm a friend of the Israelis. I'm a good friend of Mr. Begin. I'm a good friend of King Hussein. I was a good friend of President Sadat and his wife, Jihan, and now of President Mubarak. I've had a good meeting with him. And they know, those on the Arab side know that I'm friendly with those in Israel. And those in Israel know I'm friendly with the Arabs. I'm just not going to have this kind of fighting. I'm going to have cooperation. And I am trying to bring that about. But we poor humans are not going to do it by ourselves. We're just not. It's human nature. And I tell you, something that a lot of us don't like to think about. There not only is the great God above, there also is a former archangel who is now called a devil. And he's very powerful. And he is ruling this world, and the world doesn't know it. He is an invisible being. He is a prince of the power of the air.
So he explained to the president of Cyprus about Satan, about the fact that there is a devil. You need to understand that spiritual dimension to understand world news. And he wanted to make sure the president of Cyprus understood that spiritual dimension, but also the good news that there is, that Satan will be put away, and that there's a time of peace and prosperity coming very, very soon. And that's what all of these events are leading to. Thank you very much to George Haddad and Victor Granados for engineering and production. If you have any questions, any comments, you can email the show at trumpetworld@thetrumpet.com. Feel free to like, subscribe, leave comments wherever you're watching this. It helps us get the message out. You can go to the website, thetrumpet.com, or look in the show notes. If you want more information about anything that we have talked about today, we spent the first half of the show talking a lot about America Under Attack. Just a fantastic book to understanding the spiritual dimension behind what is happening in the United States. We'd be very happy to give you a free hardback copy of that book. It's such a special, important book. We even had a hardback printing run. And so we'd be very happy to send you that. And you can get that on our website, thetrumpet.com. We will be back with our regular show on Wednesday. Until then, keep watching your world.